When the couple returned to Texas in August after a hurried honeymoon in Rome, Paris, and London, Miss Cobb called me on the phone and asked me to rush immediately to Dallas, where our disbanded task force was to meet with Ransom Rusk and his new wife. And when we filed into the room to meet him, she spoke bluntly. "Ransom, my work with you on our committee and my attendance at your bull sale made me appreciate you as a real human being. And the fact that you were brave enough to marry this delightful woman from Houston confirms my feelings." "Sounds like an ominous preamble," he said. And she replied, "It is." None of us knew what she had in mind, and we were startled when she disclosed it. "I think your good friend Lorenzo did you a great service when he prevailed upon you to throw that bash. Best thing you ever did, Ransom. Made you human. But it's not enough." "What else did you have in mind?" he asked gruffly. "You're one of the richest men in our state, maybe the richest. But you've never done one damned thing for Texas, and I think that's scandalous." "Now, wait." "Oh, I know. A football scholarship here and there. Your fund for leprosy research. But I mean something commensurate with your stature."
"Like what?"
"Have you ever, in your pinched-in little life, visited the great museum complex in Fort Worth?"
"Not really. A reception now and then, but I don't like receptions."
"Are you aware that Fort Worth, which people in Dallas like to call a cow town, do you know that it has one of the world's noblest museum complexes, a perfect gem?"
"I don't know much about museums."
"You're going to find out right now." And she dragooned all of us, plus Mrs. Rusk, whom she insisted upon, and we drove over to that elegant assembly of buildings which formed one of the most graceful parts of Texas, the delicate Kimball Museum, with its splendid European paintings, the heavy Museum of Modern Art with its bold contemporary painting, and the enticing Amon Carter Museum of Western Art, with its unmatched collection of Charles Russell, Frederick Remington, and other cowboy artists. Few cities offered such a compact variety of enticing art.
"What do you want me to do?" Rusk asked when the whirlwind trip ended.
And Miss Cobb said boldly, "Rance, there's an excellent piece of land in that complex still open. I want you to place your own museum there. Build the best and stock it with the best."
"Well, I..."
"Rance, in due course, you'll be dead. Remembered for what? A gaggle of oil wells? Who gives a damn? Really, Rance, ask yourself that question, and let's meet here 2 weeks from today."
"Now, wait."
She would not wait. Standing boldly before him, she said, "Rance, I'm talking about your soul. Ask Maggie. She'll know what I mean." And she started for the door. But when she reached it, she reminded him, "2 weeks from today, and I shall want to hear your plans, because in my own way, Rance, I love you, and I cannot see you go down to your grave unremembered and uncherished." No one spoke. Of course, it was Quimper who finally broke the silence, for he did not like vacant air. "She's right, Rance. It would be a notable gesture." Rusk turned harshly on his friend. "What the hell have you ever done with your money, Quimper?" And Lorenzo said, "Get your spies to uncover how much I've given to the university. Did you know that it now has a chair of poetry in my name?" "And 40 baseball scholarships," Garza said. And Quimper laughed. "Each man to his own specialization." When the meeting broke, Rusk asked me to remain behind, and this started one of the wildest periods of my life, for he wanted me to discuss with him in the most intricate detail what would be involved if he donated a fourth museum to the Fort Worth complex. But first, we had to decide what the museum would cover.
He arranged with the university for me to take a 6-month leave, paid for by him, and patiently we went over the options. First, he suggested a cowboy museum, but I reminded him that the Amon Carter had preempted that specialty. And then, when he proposed an oil museum, I reminded him that what we were talking about was an art museum. Besides, both Midland and Kilgore already have excellent oil museums. And what's worse, oil has never produced much art. He asked me if a man like him could buy enough European art to compete with the Kimball, and I had to tell him no. Besides, that's already been done. I shall never forget the long day we spent at the Kimball, with him trying to discover what it was that justified such a magnificent building. A poem, really, for he wanted to know everything. I remember especially his comments on several of the paintings. The chef d'oeuvre of the collection was the marvelous Giovanni Bellini, Mother and Child. And when he finished studying it, he said, "That's real art, reverent." He dismissed the great Duccio, which showed Italian watchers hiding their noses as the corpse of Lazarus was raised from the dead. That's a disgrace to the Bible. He paid his longest visit to a beautiful Gainsborough, a languid young woman in a blue gown, seated beneath a tree. Miss Lloyd, the picture was titled, and I thought that she had awakened some arcane memory, for he returned to the portrait numerous times in obvious perplexity. Finally, he took out a ballpoint pen, not to make notes, but to hold it to his right eye as he made comparisons. After about 20 minutes of such study, he said, "She'd have to be 11 feet 9 inches tall." And when I restudied the delightful painting, I saw that he was right, for Gainsborough had elongated Miss Lloyd preposterously. "Whoever painted it should be fired," he growled. And I said, "Too late. He died in 1788. But he did not miss the glory of this museum, its excellent structure, and the way it fitted into its landscape. What would a building to match this one cost? I told him that with current prices it could run to 18 or 20 million minimum, and even then with far less square footage. He nodded. At 3 a.m., 3 days before our scheduled meeting with Miss Cobb, my phone rang insistently, and Rusk cried, "Come right over. I've sent my driver." And when I reached his modest Dallas quarters, in which the new Mrs. Rusk shared the lone bedroom and bath, I found both of them in nightrobes, in the bedroom, surrounded by a blizzard of newspapers. "I've got my museum." I was reading in bed, running options through my mind, and I asked myself, "What is the biggest thing in Texas?" And this newspaper here gave me the answer. It was a Thursday edition of the Dallas Morning News, and I looked for the headlines to provide a clue, but I could not find any. Instead, Rusk had about him 8 special sections which the paper had added that day, making it one of the biggest weekday papers I'd seen. He grabbed my arm and asked, "What is the biggest thing in Texas?" And I said, "Religion, but the cathedrals take care of that." "Guess again." And I said, "Oil? But Midland and Kilgore handle that." "And again." And I said, "Ranching. But the Amon Carter Museum covers that." So he slapped the 8 special sections of the newspaper and said, "Look for yourself. The Dallas News knows what really counts." And when I picked up the sections, I found that the paper, in response to an insatiable hunger among its Texas readers, had published 112 pages of extra football news. Professional, with accent on Dallas. Professional, other teams. Colleges, with accent on Texas teams. Colleges, the others. High schools, very thick. High schools, how star players should handle recruiting. 16 full pages on the latter. Plus, of course, the customary 16 pages of current football news. Or 128 pages in all.
Rusk, having made his great discovery, beamed like a boy who had seen the light regarding the Pythagorean theorem.
Sport. And as soon as he uttered that almost sacred word, I could see an outstanding museum added to those in the park.
Neither he nor I, and certainly not Maggie Rusk, visualized it as a sports hall of fame filled with old uniforms and used boxing gloves. Every state tried that, often disastrously. No, what we saw was a real art museum, a legitimate hall of beauty, filled with notable examples of how sports had so often inspired artists to produce work of the first category. No junk, no baseball cards, no old uniforms.
Rusk was speaking at 4 in the morning. Just great paintings, like that Madonna we saw.
I warned him that the art sales rooms were not filled with Bellini studies of football players, but he dismissed the objection. It will be American art depicting American sports.
And when dawn broke, we three went out to an all-night truck stop and had scrambled eggs.
By the time Miss Cobb and the others reached Dallas that weekend, the Rusks had a full prospectus roughed out. But before they were allowed to present it, Miss Cobb distributed a glossy pamphlet that had been printed in high style by the Smithsonian in Washington.
Before we mention specific plans, I want to upgrade your horizons. I want us to do something significant, and to do that, we must entertain significant thoughts.
Holding the pamphlet in her hand, she looked directly at Rusk and Quimper.
You two clowns thought very big with your bull sale. Glorious. Real Texas. My two Cobb senators would have applauded. They said it was important to keep alive the old traditions.
And I must confess, Rance and Lorenzo, you not only kept them alive, you added a few touches. Now look at someone else who has thought big.
I was perplexed when I looked at my copy of the pamphlet, for it apparently recounted a gala affair at the Smithsonian, in which a Texas oil and technology man had been honored by the President, the Chief Justice, and some 100 dignitaries from American and European universities. It was a rather thick pamphlet, and 3/4 of it was taken up by photographs. Before I could inspect them, Rusk said,
"I worked with him, one of the best."
What the rear 2/3 of the pamphlet showed were the 27 colleges and universities to which the Texan had given either magnificent solo buildings or entire complexes. Any one would have been the gesture of a lifetime. A tower at MIT, a quadrangle at the University of Vancouver in Canada, a school of geology at Sydney in Australia. But when I saw the two entire colleges, and I mean all the buildings which he had given to Cambridge in England and the Sorbonne in France, I was staggered. 27 tremendous monuments dug from the soil of the most barren fields in Texas. 27 halls of learning. The total cost? Incalculable. But there they stood, in 9 unconnected corners of the world, more than half in the United States, and more than half of those in Texas, centers of learning and of light.
"I want us all to think in those terms," Miss Cobb said. And Rusk snapped, "It's my money we're talking about." And she said,
"My father always told us, rich people need guidance. We're here to help you, Rance, because we love you, and we don't want to see you miss the big parade. Now, what bright idea did you and Barlow come up with?"
"Sport," Rusk said. And Miss Cobb asked,
"You mean one of those pathetic halls of fame, old jockstraps cast in bronze, old men recalling the lost days of their youth?"
"I do not," Rusk snapped.
I mean an art museum, as legitimate as any in the world. Fine art, like the Kimball, but glorifying sport.
Miss Cobb pondered this, and then said enthusiastically, "That could be most effective, Ransom. But don't keep it parochially American. Be universal."
"You mean art from all the world?" he asked. And she replied, "I do. We Americans forget that our three big sports, football, baseball, basketball, are focused here. If you do this, don't be parochial."
If there was one thing the new Texan, of whom Rusk was a prototype, did not want to be, it was parochial.
"You make sense, Lorena."
Then, turning to me, he issued an imperial ukaz. "Marlowe, we'll make it universal."
At the end of that long day, she kissed Ransom. "I have a feeling, Rance, you'll do it right. Make Quimper your treasurer. He likes to spend other people's money. And keep Barlow at your side. He'll know what art is."
Early next morning, Rusk summoned me to his office. "Hire the man who built the Kimball and tell him to get started."
"Louis J. Kahn is dead. That was his masterpiece."
"Get me the next man, just as good."
"They don't come just as good, but there are several around who design buildings of great beauty."
"Get me the best, and have him start his drawings this weekend."
"Architects don't work that way," I warned him, and he growled, "This time they will." And within a month, an architect from Chicago, noted for buildings of great style which caught the spirit of the West, was making provisional designs for a new kind of museum ideally suited to the Fort Worth site. And 2 months later, ground was broken, with no announcement having been made to the public. In the meantime, I had opened an office in New York, to which all the dealers in America, it seemed, traipsed in with samples of their wares. And I was astonished at how many fine American artists had created works based on sport. With a budget larger than any I had ever played with, even in my imagination, I put together a guiding committee of 7, 3 art experts, 2 artists, and 2 businessmen unfamiliar with Texas or Ransom Rusk. And with the most meticulous care, we began reserving a few pieces we would probably want to buy when we started our actual accumulations. Rusk flew in from Dallas to see if we were prepared to fill his fine new museum when the scores of builders and landscape architects, working overtime, had it ready. For when a Texas billionaire cried, "Let us have a museum," zingo, he wanted it right now. Loath to accept personal responsibility for what he termed this disgraceful delay, I assembled my committee and 7 major curators and experts for a day's meeting at the Pierre, and there we thrashed out our problems. Rusk listened as a curator from the Metropolitan explained that in the case of a wonderful Thomas Eakins painting, Charles Rogers Fishing, negotiations with the present owners could require as much as a year. The Sturdivant family is divided. Half want to sell, the other half don't. A matter of settling the old man's estate.
"Then we'll forget that one," Rusk snapped.
But the Met man counseled patience. "Were you fortunate enough to get that Eakins, it alone would set the style for your whole museum. Men like me and Charles here, we'd have to come to Fort Worth to see what other good things you have."
"You're satisfied there's enough out there to build a top-notch museum?"
"Unquestionably." And they all grew rhapsodic over the possibilities. One man from Cleveland summarized the situation. "Even we were uninformed as to the magnificent possibilities. In the short time we've worked, we've come up with a dazzling list of how artists have portrayed men engaged in sports. Ancient Greek statues, Roman athletes, Degas jockeys, Stubbs' unmatched portraits of racing horses. Never heard of that one. Who was he?
George Stubbs of England, 1724 to 1806. No one ever painted horses better than Stubbs.
Can we buy one of his works? I mean, one of his recognized masterpieces?
And that was the question which led to the explosive idea which got the Fort Worth Museum of Sports Art launched with a bang that no one like me could have engineered. Because when these experts explained that to find a Stubbs or a Degas that might be coming onto the market took infinite patience and a high degree of skill to negotiate the sale, Rusk saw that his building was going to be finished long before he had much to put in it.
The things you've been talking about are European. I understand why they might be difficult to find and deal for, but how about American art? Have we produced any good things?
It was here that the experts became poetic. Wonderful things. But again, Mr. Rusk, all requiring many months of bargaining and cajoling.
Why can't we just find a good painting and say, "I'll take that"?
And the man from Cleveland laughed.
Mr. Rusk, if it were that easy, experts like us would lose our jobs.
I now set up a screen, and with slides I'd been accumulating, gave a preview of the Rusk Museum, with the experts gasping at the beauty of some of the artwork we'd located but not yet purchased. And several times some museum curator would sigh, "I'd like to get that one," at which a member of our staff would warn, "Remember, we were promised that Fort Worth would get first crack." I showed a marvelous Winslow Homer, one of the finest George Bellows prize fight canvases, cattle roping scenes by Tom Lee, Charles Russell, and Frederick Remington, a masterful George Bingham, which someone said we might get for $800,000, and a wonderful semi-hunting scene by Georgia O'Keeffe. But the one which brought cheers was a football scene by Wayne Thiebaud, entitled Running Guard 77, in which an exhausted lineman sat dejected on the bench, his huge numbers filling the canvas. 19 fine paintings in all flashed across that screen. And at the end, the man from the Met said, "Mr. Rusk, if you can land those 19 beauties, you're in business. Add 19 like them, and you have a museum." And then Rusk returned to his penetrating question. "How long to buy them, assuming we can find the money?" And the man agreed, "Maybe 3 years, if you're lucky."
"I can't wait 3 years," Rusk said.
"Why don't we borrow them? Let people see the kind of stuff we're after." A hush fell over the darkened room as these wise men, who had assembled so many enlightening and enriching shows of borrowed art, contemplated this perceptive question. And finally, the man from Boston said with guarded enthusiasm, "Mr. Rusk, if it were done right, and if you could establish a committee of sufficient gravity to give the thing credibility with the foreign museums, goodness." His confreres were less inhibited. "It's never been done. It's a capital idea. I can think right now of 40 items you'll have, and probably can get." I had rarely seen a workable idea catch such immediate fire, and within the hour we had put together recommendations for a prestigious group of financial and publicity sponsors. Reaching for the list, Rusk began telephoning the well-known men and women and received the consent of most. At the same time, the rest of us were drawing up a list of great works of art from various museums in the world, and plans were launched to request loans for a huge show to open the Fort Worth Sports Museum. When Texans dream, they do so in Technicolor. Then something happened which brought our meeting back to an equally exciting reality. A New York dealer,
who had sat outside, waiting to present 7 good canvases for my inspection, asked if he could now come in, and I was pleased to see that these world-famous experts were always eager to see whatever the art world was putting forth. He was a modest man, as were his 7 canvases. But after we had been soaring in the Empyrean, it was good to come back to earth. These are fine works, of museum quality and condition. I have wanted you to see what is immediately available. And he showed us a perfectly splendid painting by a man I had not heard of, John Corbino, of athletes posturing on a beach, and then an exhilarating oil by Fletcher Martin titled Out at Second. It presented a baseball ballet, showing the runner coming in from first with a hook slide to the right, the shortstop sweeping down with a tag from the left, and the energetic umpire throwing his arm up in the hooking out signal. When the man completed his presentation, Rusk said, "Would you please step outside for a moment?" And when he was gone, Ransom asked his advisers, "I liked them, but were they good enough for a museum?" And the experts agreed they were. "Call him in," Rusk told me. And when the dealer returned, Rusk said, "We'll take them all." "But we haven't talked price, sir." "Barlow will do that, and I've already warned him to offer no more than half what you ask." "With your permission, I've brought along a European painting I thought you might want to consider. It's certainly not American, and the sport it presents isn't the way we play it today. But please, take a look." And he placed on the easel a rather small canvas painted by the Dutch painter Hendrik Aberkamp, 1585-1634, showing a frozen canal near Amsterdam, with lively little men in ancient costume playing ice hockey. It was the epitome of sport, timeless, set in nature, animated, real. And in addition, it was a significant work of art. The curators and experts applauded so noisily that I cried, "Accession number 1. But Rusk forestalled me. "We want it, surely. That's just the kind of thing we do want. So old, so beautiful. But not as our first acquisition. I've already bought that, and it ought to be in Fort Worth, ready for installation when we get back." This man Rusk never ceased to surprise me, for when I returned to Fort Worth 2 weeks later, I found that he had installed in the rotunda of his emerging museum a splendid antique Italian copy of perhaps the most famous sports art item in the world, the dazzling Discobolus of Myron, dating back to the original Olympic Games. "Where'd you get it?" I asked. And he said, "Old Italian palace. Saw it on our honeymoon, and remembered it ever since." An art dealer from New York had come to Dallas with color slides of 8 canvases relating to sport, including a Thomas Hart Benton of a rodeo cowboy trying to rope a steer. And I was concluding arrangements for their purchase when Ransom Rusk phoned urgently from Larkin. "Come right over. Catastrophe." Since Rusk rarely pushed the panic button, I excused myself, hopped in the car Rusk provided when I worked in Dallas, and sped out to the mansion, where in the African hall I met Rusk and Mr. Kramer, the armadillo expert, in mournful discussion with a Dr. Philippe Leroux of Louisiana, a very thin man with beard and piercing eye. When I looked at his card and fumbled with his name, he said, "Pronounce it Leroux. Half my family changed it to that when they reached America." "Tell him the bad news," Rusk said, slumping into a chair made from the tusks of elephants he and his partners had shot on safari. And Leroux, standing straight as if giving a laboratory lecture to a class of pre-meds, revealed a shocking situation. "We have solid reason for believing that the armadillo not only serves as a laboratory host for the study of human leprosy, but can also infect people with the disease." There was a painful silence as we four stared at one another. LaRue stood rigid, prepared to defend his accusation. Mr. Kramer, whose years in retirement had focused on Texas storms and the armadillo, looked mutely from one of us to the other, unable to speak. Rusk, whose walls bespoke his constant interest in animals, was confused. And I, whose only contact with the armadillo had been chuckling at the beer advertisements which featured them, did not know what to think. Finally, LaRue spoke. "We're recommending that since the threat of leprosy is real, and since we have identified 5 documented cases in Texas in which persons handling the animals have contracted it, all armadillos that might come into contact with humans be eradicated." "You mean we're to poison them?" Rusk asked. "Or shoot them?" Mr. Kramer rose, moved about for some moments, then looked out toward the former bowling lawn. "I could not shoot an armadillo. I suspect your evidence is nothing but rumors." "I wish it were," LaRue said. "But I assure you, the danger is real." "Actual cases?" Kramer asked, his white hair glowing in the morning sunlight. "Yes." "And you're recommending extermination?" Rusk asked. "We are. And so are the experts in Florida and the epidemiologists in Atlanta." And hearing this verdict delivered with such solemn authority, Rusk said, "As responsible citizens, we must do something. But what?" "You have 2 choices. You can shoot them all." "I'd never do that," Rusk snapped. "They're my friends." "Or you can trap the lot and ship them to our research station in Carville, Louisiana." While Rusk considered this, LaRue added, "You'd be doing us a considerable favor. Leprosy is a terrible disease if left unchecked, only minor if treated quickly. Your armadillos could help us to solve some of the mysteries." "We'll let you have them," Rusk said. And I remained in Larkin with LaRue for the remainder of that week, while Rusk supervised a team of his illegal Mexican workmen in placing traps about the lawn. When the young armadillos there had been captured and caged for shipment, the Mexicans were loaned to Mr. Kramer, who was busy trapping other animals known to be at various spots around Larkin. And when that task was completed, LaRue told us, "I feel better, and assure you that you are much safer than you were a week ago." He returned to Louisiana that afternoon, so that only Rusk, Kramer, and I were present when the improvised lights came on, and we saw the old mother armadillo come out alone, for her 8 children were gone, and stand in perplexity in the middle of the bowling green. Mr. Kramer said, "Don't trap her, Mr. Rusk. She knows she belongs here." Years back, when I studied geography, a professor drummed into us the fact that we must never stumble into the pathetic fallacy, and I remember asking him what it was. The sentimental attributing of human motivations to inanimate objects like angry clouds or the vengeful tornado. It's particularly offensive to attribute to animals such human reactions as "the mother buffalo was eager to fight off the wolves," or "the collie obviously preferred the runt of her litter." Things are things, and animals are not humans. Treat them dispassionately. Now, when Mr. Kramer was presuming to explain what the mother armadillo was thinking, I rejected his assumptions. She was not mourning the loss of her children, nor was she recalling the good times she'd had on this lawn. My scientific training forced me to think of her as a dumb animal that might be carrying leprosy, and I felt no other emotion as I watched the workmen close in on her when Rusk signaled, "Edge her toward the trap." But she had always been a canny creature, and now some instinct warned her that with the disappearance of her children, she also was in peril. So, evading the trap, she scurried toward the entrance to her underground sanctuary. Normally, a nimble man can run down an armadillo, and since there were three Mexicans ready to chase her, they should have nabbed her, but she made a dive between their legs and escaped. "You'll have to shoot that one," someone said. "I've seen old-timers like her fool the best trappers." So Rusk asked a servant to fetch from the African hall a high-powered rifle used normally on elephants or Cape Buffalo. Handing it to Mr. Kramer, he said, "Take care of her." But Kramer refused to do so. Rejecting the gun, he told Rusk, "She's your responsibility, not mine." I thought it appropriate that Ransom, who had in a sense sponsored the armadillos in Larkin, should eliminate the colony. And when the mother of them all came out of her hole to investigate the ominous silence, he drew a bead on her. But he could not pull the trigger. Looking at me pleadingly, he said, "I can't do it." And I found myself with the rifle. Ping. The armadillos of Larkin were no more. The next months were some of the most exciting I have ever spent, because into our temporary offices in Fort Worth came a sequence of cables which caused us to rejoice. The Louvre is pleased to inform you that we shall be sending the Degas Horse Race at Antuille, the Cezanne Wrestlers at the Beach, and the Latour Duel at Midnight. From Tokyo came word that a museum would ship 9 Japanese prints of the most glowing quality depicting the greatest of the ancient sumo wrestlers, Tanikaze, who flourished in the late 18th century. When they arrived, I decided that they must have a small room of their own, for they were bound to be one of the hits of the opening show. This massive human figure, more than 350 pounds, with its sense of controlled power, all shown in high style by 4 different artists of world class. The cable from the Prado in Madrid caused both jubilation and fracas, because we were being sent a precious first printing of Goya's remarkable series of etchings on bullfighting, plus a glowing canvas of same, and our Mexican population showered encomiums upon us for paying this tribute to Hispanic art. But a dedicated women's group opposed to bullfighting warned that they would picket our opening if it included the Goyas, and a wild brouhaha erupted in the press. Less provocative was the cable from Scotland, promising a rare series of prints depicting the development of golf. Rusk appreciated that. And another cable from London completed our foreign loans. "We shall be sending you a notable collection of rare prints and canvases, big enough to fill 2 rooms, showing the world's most popular sport, if attendance alone is the criterion, horse racing." I was delighted with the prospect of hanging that part of the show, because I like horses, and so did Rusk. It was now apparent that this opening show was going to be not only a spectacular success, with art of the highest quality from unexpected corners of the world, but also the first ever of its kind. And as I studied photographs of the 300 items that would comprise the exhibition and began to allot each to its probable location in the building, which was being rushed to conclusion, I became aware that I was making decisions that ought to be the prerogative of whoever was going to direct the museum over the long run. But we had no director, and I took steps to correct this deficiency. "Mr. Rusk, you really must get your top man in position, and soon." "I have that in hand, Barlow," he assured me. And the next day, as I sat in his office, I overheard 2 of the strangest phone calls of my life. My close contact with Rusk over the past years had made me appreciate the man. I had watched him grow in courage during the disasters and in wisdom as he reached out to embrace a larger world. Before my eyes, he had matured, as I hoped I would mature in my new position. I not only liked him now, I respected him. However, he could at times do the damnedest things, and these two calls ranked high on the roster of Rusk improbables. "Get me Tom Landry," he told his secretary. And shortly, he was speaking to the coach of the Dallas Cowboys. "Tom, this is Ransom."
"Yes."
"Tom, I need your confidential advice. Is Wolfgang McNabb what you would call manly?" I could hear Landry sputter as he defended his linebacker, after which Rusk said, "I know all that, Tom, but you must have heard the stories that are surfacing. Defensive tackles kissing each other at the end of the game." Again Landry sputtered, so Rusk put it to him straight. "Tom, can you assure me that Wolfgang is manly? You know what I mean. Not queer?" Apparently Landry wanted to know what in hell Rusk was talking about, and he must have given Ransom a dressing down, because Rusk said, "Of course he's my son-in-law, but a lot's riding on this, and I have to be sure. Any man who studies art, you've got to suspect him." Landry made some comment, and Rusk continued, "You ought to see some of the so-called experts up in New York who've been spending my money. Yes, for my new museum. If you ever visited Fort Worth, you'd know about it." Assured by Landry that Wolfman McNabb was a macho terror, Rusk now called his trusted friend Joe Robbie of the Miami Dolphins and asked me to listen in. Rusk: "Hiya, Joe. Your old buddy Rance Rusk." Robbie: "You fellows showing anything this year?" Rusk: "Always enough to beat you bums." Joe: "I want to ask a very personal question. Most important to me." Robbie: "Shoot. I owe you one for your help on our boy Martinez." Rusk: "In your opinion, is Wolfgang McNabb manly?" Robbie: "Hell, Don Shula's been trying to get him for 3 years. Shula doesn't fool around." Rusk: "I know he's a good player, the one-man gang they call him, but is he... you know what I mean?" Robbie: "How would I know anything like that? All my players are Democrats." Rusk: "You know those rumors about football professionals, that bit about defensive tackles?" Robbie: "Forget it. McNabb's the best." Rusk: "Thanks a million, Joe." That afternoon, Rusk summoned Wolfgang McNabb to his office, and when the All-Pro was seated, Rusk said, out of the blue, "Son, I want you to be the director of my sports museum. Don't speak. You've got 1, 2 more years of professional ball. Good, stay with it. But at our big press conference Friday, I want to announce you as our director." "I love art, Mr. Rusk. I know something about it. But director? A major museum?" "If you can handle those Pittsburgh running backs, you can handle a bunch of paintings." "You know, sir, I take art far more seriously than I do football. I'm not kidding around." "I wouldn't want you if you were." They discussed salary, and McNabb almost fell out of his chair at its proposed size. So did I. And then the young man showed his maturity by asking a penetrating question. "As director, would I have a small budget for acquisition of new works?" "You sure would. As of today, assuming you take the job, you have $32 million on deposit." When McNabb blanched, no more stunned than I, Rusk rose and put his arm about his shoulders. "Never forget, son, when you represent Texas, always go first class." This novel is dedicated to 3 distinguished literary critics. I have been informed that many books of fiction, which are unrelated to religion, go to the Indies, which would include what later became Texas. Since this is bad practice, I commend you, therefore, from this time henceforth, neither to permit nor allow any person at all to take any books of fiction there, but only those relating to the Christian religion and morality. No other kind is to be allowed. I, the Queen of Spain, 4th of April, 1531. She issued this order while the king was busy in another country. Another damned thick, square book. Always scribble, 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 eh, Mr. Gibbon? William Henry, Duke of Gloucester, to the author of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, 1781. He never amounted to much. Third, my will is that my sons receive solid and useful education. I wish them to be early taught an utter contempt for novels. Sam Houston, his last will and testament, the 2nd of April, 1863. He was forced to surrender almost every good job he ever had. Acknowledgements. Arrangements for my 30-month research work in Texas were made by then-Governor William Clements, who fulfilled every promise he made, and to whom I am grateful. My neighbor, Margaret Wilson, and my landlord, Jack Taylor, were helpful in arranging several of the meetings listed. I wish to thank the following for enlightening me on many facets of Texas life and history. Land. Virginia Madison, Hallie Stilwell, and Professor Barton Warnock of Sewell Ross University on the Alpine area, Horace Gore on the land formations of East Texas, Clayton Williams on West Texas. Water. Water, not oil, is the lifeblood of Texas, and the Ogallala Aquifer controls the availability of water for West Texas. During many local inspections of aquifer-fed land, the following were helpful. Dr. Idris Traylor of Texas Tech on the basics, David Underwood of Lubbock and Joe Unfred on utilization, Daryl Oliver of Muleshoe on deep wells. Data on rainfall and climatology in general were checked against Texas Weather, a new book on the subject by George W. Bomar. Mr. Bomar of the Texas Department of Water Resources, Weather and Climate Section, personally provided data for the rainfall map. David Murrah, Texas Tech, helped with books. Animals. R.P. Marshall of the King Ranch spent 2 fine days with me lecturing on the habits of quail, and V.W. Lehman allowed me to read the manuscript of his masterful research study. It is now a beautifully illustrated book and the authoritative work on quail. Sam Lewis of San Angelo, fastest tongue in the West, introduced me to the armadillo, and Don English, present owner of the historic Appelt Armadillo Farm, allowed me to work with their lively stock. Professor Robin Doty verified recent scientific data on these controversial little animals. Horace Gore taught me about wild turkeys and took me on a hunt. Bob Ramsey of Hunt showed me how to rattle up a buck, and also how to make flint arrowheads in caveman style. Cotton. Because the cultivation, ginning, and utilization of this important fiber would form a leitmotif of the novel, I needed to do intensive work in 3 different parts of the state. Professors Ray Frisbee and Joe Knox Walker of Texas A&M on controlling the boll weevil, the Harris Underwood family of Lubbock on dryland cultivation, Mike McDonald on preparing cotton for industrial use, Robert Hale of Littlefield on milling denim. Ranching. Ranch life is still a salient feature of Texas, and I was privileged to visit some of the best known or most typical. Mary Lewis Clayburg and Teo Clayburg of the vast King Ranch were repeatedly hospitable. B.K. Johnson of La Pryor was instructive. I attended 2 of his cattle sales. Bill Blakemore showed me his large spread near Alpine. In the same vicinity, D.J. Sibley and his wife Jane shared their fairy tale castle atop a mountain, with the 6 battlement towers, one for each of the Texas flags. The Prunell cages of Falfurrias not only let me inspect their ranch, but also showed me my first mesquite flooring. At Dripping Springs, the H.C. Carters offered friendship and expertise, and the Hardy Bowmans allowed me to participate in a birthday party at their ranch. Nancy Nigley of San Antonio and the Palomas Ranch arranged a quail and turkey hunt for my instruction, and the Eliseo Garcias of Encino showed me one of the oldest ranches in Texas. In Old Mexico, Charlie and Chabela Sellers of Sabinas entertained delightfully. Bill Moody and Violet Jarrett of Del Rio graciously explained their ranches, as did Mac and Eleanor McCollum of Houston. At his ranch near Brownwood, Treldon Cutbirth gave me a fine introduction to old-style barbecuing. Exotic Game Ranching. I developed a special interest in how Texas ranchers endeavor to preserve certain forms of wildlife that may be disappearing in other parts of the world. The famous Y.O. Ranch of Kerrville allowed me to prowl its pastures. Veterinarian Dr. Stephen Seeger of A&M invited me to watch his researches in the field. Thomas Mansell of Fort Worth had more sable antelope on his ranch than I ever saw in Africa. Lou and Wanda Waters of Utopia had a splendid ranch. And John Meekum, Jr. of Houston invited me to watch the dispersal of his huge exotic game ranch along the Rio Grande. Dale Pryor of Ingram provided technical data. Longhorns. Charlene and Red McCombs of Johnson City invited me to their ranch for various events and also shared several hours with me on the revival of this historic breed. Jack Montgomery of Yuma, Colorado read my segments on the Longhorn. Joan and H.C. Carter of Dripping Springs were always helpful, as was Walter Schreiner of the Y.O. Ranch. Don and Linda Wiley of Austin took me to a chain of Longhorn ranches. Spanish backgrounds. So much for the land, now for the historical subject matter. On the Spanish heritage, San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros was most helpful. Victor Niemeyer of the Institute of Latin American Studies at the University of Texas arranged for valuable contacts in Mexico, where Dr. Israel Cavazos of Monterrey and Jesus Alfonso Areola and Javier Guerra Escandón of Saltillo offered perceptive comments. Countless consultants in both Mexico and Texas offered help of basic understandings. And the fact that I had previously written an entire book on Spanish culture speeded the discussions. Spanish mission life. Dr. Felix D. Almaraz, Jr. of San Antonio showed me in detail the great missions of that city. Ben Pingeno of Eagle Pass shared his unrivaled knowledge of San Juan Bautista, the mission which was so important in early settlement in Texas. Charles Long, the lively curator of the Alamo, was repeatedly helpful in sharing with me his knowledge of that historic mission. And Gilbert R. Cruz, National Parks historian, provided additional highlights. Constant visits to the other monuments of San Antonio were necessary, the restored Governor's Palace being especially instructive. Early American settlement. Drew McCoy of Brazoria showed me around that crucial area. Officials of the Star of the Republic Museum at Washington on the Brazos were helpful, as were custodians of other valuable collections, especially Dorman Winfrey of the Texas State Library. For a basic understanding of how the early settlers reacted to the land they were occupying, I am indebted to D. W. Meinig's excellent geographical study, Imperial Texas. Clifton Caldwell generously presented research material. The Trace. John S. Molenrich of the National Park Service was instructive regarding the history of this important road, which I traveled twice. Ranger actors who portrayed historical characters at stops en route were much appreciated. Rita Stevens of Natchez told me much about the old days on the Mississippi. Scottish and Scots-Irish backgrounds. Myra and Gordon Porter of Carnoustie, Scotland, who own much of the land described in Glen Lyon, shepherded me around most of northern Scotland. Ailsa and Alfred Fife of Cupar, classmates of mine at St. Andrews in 1932, helped and edited the Scottish material. Three Battles. Anyone writing about the Alamo finds the ground well prepared by two fine books, which do not necessarily coincide in their interpretations. 13 Days to Glory by Lon Tinkle and A Time to Stand by Walter Lord. I checked with each, but obviously did not follow either entirely. I spent many hours inside the Alamo talking with all the local experts. The Daughters of the Republic of Texas library staff proved most helpful. For my study of the tragedy at Goliad, I am indebted to Charles Faupel and Mary Jane Plum, who live in the small town of that name. For basic data of the Battle of San Jacinto, a critical moment in Texas history, I am indebted to Dr. Thomas H. Krennick, in whose care I toured the site, and to J. P. Bryan of Houston. For Sam Houston's conduct prior to the battle, I followed a recent publication of Dr. Archie P. McDonald, Stephen F. Austin State University. Germans. Irma Goethe Günther, granddaughter of a wonderful diarist who came to Texas from Germany in 1845, was a delightful correspondent. Clifford and Sarah Harl of Fredericksburg went far beyond the demands of hospitality to help, and Ella Gold's memories were sharp and lively. Matthew Gouger of Kerrville showed me significant sights. August Fulton of Comfort was repeatedly helpful, and the writings of Glenn E. Lick of Schreiner College were most useful. Texas Rangers. Gaines de Graffenreid, guiding genius of the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame at Waco, was constantly helpful, as was his associate, Alva Stem. Former Rangers, Alfred Ali and Walter Russell, were especially informative, the latter giving me a stout walking stick he had used in his ranging days. H. Joaquin Jackson of Uvalde was informative, and some of my best days in Texas were spent with Clayton McKinney of Alpine. For a review of Texas Ranger activities during the Mexican War, I am indebted to Dr. Thomas H. Krennick, who allowed me to read his manuscript on the subject. South Carolina. Mary Frampton of Edisto Island was so generous in sharing with me her recollection of Edisto life that she merits special thanks. To Alan Powell of the Charleston Historical Society, I am indebted for an idea which proved most helpful in structuring the novel. Jefferson. I spent many happy hours in this gracious old town. Mrs. Lucille Bullard was my frequent hostess, and I spent a rewarding day with Wyatt Moore of Karnak, the leading authority of the days when Jefferson was, in effect, a seaport. Numerous Jeffersonians were helpful, especially Mrs. Lucille Terry. Professor Fred Tarpley of East Texas State University allowed me to read the manuscript of his book, Jefferson, Riverport of the Southwest, the best book on this area, and arranged several valuable local contacts. Slavery. I did much work on this painful subject. Randolph B. Campbell of North Texas State University allowed me to read his remarkable manuscript on how slavery operated in the Marshall-Jefferson area. It is now a fine book, A Southern Community in Crisis. Doris Pemberton of Houston talked to me at different times. Various librarians drew my attention to important studies. Dr. James Byrd, Commerce, and Trailer Russell, Mount Pleasant, also offered their insight. Vicksburg. This great battlefield obviously haunted me. I spent 3 research trips there, following the experiences of the 2nd Texas Infantry. Catherine C. Garvin provided tour help during one of the trips, and the park staff answered many of my detailed queries. Frontier Forts. I visited in depth some dozen of these variously preserved sites. At Fort Belknap, Barbara Ledbetter, an enthusiastic local historian, helped. Throughout, Robert Wooster, working toward his Ph.D. in Western military history, provided sensitive guidance. He is writing his own book on the subject. I also had the honor of being thrown out of Fort Davis, a U.S. national park, and perhaps the best restored of the Texas forts. Alas, I never saw it. Fort Garner Larkin. To construct this imaginary fort and town, I worked with sites and scholars throughout the entire area. I visited especially all the extant courthouses of that architectural genius, James Riley Gordon. At Waxahachie, I met with M. E. Singleton, a man younger than I, whose grandfather, improbable as it seems, fought at San Jacinto. Oil. Martin Alday of Midland arranged 3 extensive seminars on Western oil fields, most of which I visited in detail. The following are some of the many who gave generously of their time and knowledge. J. H. Fullenweider, B. J. Peavehouse, Tom Seeley, J. C. Williamson, Ford Chapman, Patsy Yeager, Tom Fowler, and Joe Hiram Moore. Don Evans took me on a field trip. John Cox was especially helpful on oil field financing. Bill Benson of Cheyenne, Wyoming, first put me in touch with the Graham area, about which I would write, and Joe Benson and Ken Andrews explained in detail how oil field royalties were distributed. In Livingston, Ben Ogletree arranged a unique experience. At 3 o'clock one morning, I stood with him at a drilling site when a well came in. In appreciation of the good luck which he thought I had brought him, he named this substantial field after me. Religion. I held many separate discussions about the role of religion in Texas, but the most informative was a 3-day seminar with the scholars at Abilene Christian University. Professors Ian Fair, Richard Hughes, Bill Humble, and R. L. Roberts. Gary McCaleb, public affairs officer at the university, was especially helpful. At a small rural church in McMahon, I heard the unique sacred harp shaped note singing. William N. Stokes, Jr. allowed me to see his rousing account of how his father was churched for allowing members of his Sunday school class in Vernon to dance. Football. In Abilene, I also conducted a seminar on the 2nd Texas religion, high school football. Wally Bullington, A. E. Wells, W. L. Lawson, David Borland, and particularly Beverly Ball, who told fascinating stories about the role of girl students and women teachers. George Brazil, high school expert for the Austin American Statesman, was helpful, but my special debt is to Dave Campbell of Waco, publisher of a spectacularly successful magazine about Texas football. On the university level, Coach Darrell Royal, formerly of the University of Texas, was exemplary in his sharing of knowledge of ideas. Border problems. On 3 occasions, I worked with the Border Patrol along the Rio Grande. Officers James J. Fulgham, Dennis L. Cogburn, Clifford Green, and William Seltzer allowed me to accompany them on patrols in the Laredo district. In El Paso, I worked with Alan E. Eliason, William G. Harrington, Dale Cozart, and Raymond Reeves. Mexican problems. I was meeting with Isidra Vizcaya Canales, a factory manager in Monterrey, when the peso was devalued. I was serving in Mexico City as an official of the United States government when relations between the two countries deteriorated. I conducted seminars in various parts of Texas to obtain a wide scatter of opinions. Nowhere did I find unanimity as to what might happen by the year 2010. In Corpus Christi, Dr. Hector P. Garcia was most helpful, and in the same city, Tony Bonilla, president of the famous LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens, was instructive. Yolanda and Mario Isaguirre of Brownsville were especially gracious and arranged a field trip to Baghdad, and I profited from discussions with Paredes Manzano and Robert Vizzetti of that city. Texas business. In the latter chapters of this novel, writing about business and wealth became inescapable. I had the privilege of talking, sometimes at extended length, with the following experts: Trammell Crowe, Vester Hughes, John Busick, and Bunker Hunt of Dallas; Gerald Hines, Walter Mischer, Sr., and George Mitchell of Houston; Clayton Williams, Bill Blakemore, and John Cox of Midland; David Adikas, an artist friend from the old days in Japan, allowed me to inspect the record of his real estate dabblings, and many others in many locations talked with me about money problems, including John M. Stemmons, Louis Sklar, and Larry Budner. Honky-tonks. I enjoyed extended interviews with the owners of the two premier honky-tonks in Texas, Sherman Cryer of Gillies in Pasadena, Texas, and Billy Bob Barnett of Billy Bob's in Fort Worth. Each owner was a novel in himself. Each of the dance halls was overwhelming. Rio Grande Valley. I wanted to represent adequately and honestly the unique Mexican-American world of the Valley and its citrus industry. Professor Julian Soles of the USDA Citrus Laboratory, Les Whitlock of the Citrus Committee, Professor Dick Hens of the Texas A&I Citrus Center, and Clyde White, president of the Texas Cooperative Exchange. Former Governor Alan Shivers and his wife were especially helpful in inviting me to visit their Sherryland home near Mission, where their manager, Blaine H. Holcomb, gave valuable instruction on the citrus industry. Miscellaneous interviews. Robert Nesbitt, Galveston; Hayden and Annie Blake Head, Corpus Christi; Nelson Franklin and Dean Cobb, Austin; Ed and Susan Owler, Toe; Tom Moore, Lajitas; Cactus Pryor and John Henry Falk, Austin, provided caustic comment. Airplane flights. It is obvious from the above listing that I had to visit all of Texas, not only the easy parts. And in doing so, I was dependent upon generous neighbors who allowed me to use their planes. Trammell Crowe and John Blanton of Dallas, Mary Louise Clayburg of the King Ranch, Walter Mischer, Sr. of Houston, H. C. Carter, Joe Hiram Moore, and Howell Finch of Austin, the last named flying me at very low levels over most of the western oil fields, Bill Blakemore and Robert Holt of Midland, Charles C. Butt of Corpus Christi, and Pranal Cage of Falfurrias, who flew me over the sandbanks of Padre Island. I also flew with Clayton Williams on several occasions. He lent me his helicopter for 2 days of wild exploration in far west Texas. And Bob Macy flew me over the cotton farms of Levelland. When I told Clifford Green of Laredo that I wanted to see the Rio Grande close up from the air, he took me on an extended flight in a one-engine plane along the river at an altitude so low that I had to look almost straight up to see the top of the banks above me. University of Texas. I enjoyed constant cooperation and scholarly assistance from many faculty members of the university. President Peter Flawn was both understanding and helpful. Dean of Graduate Studies William Livingston swiftly resolved any quandaries. Director Don Carlton of the Barker, Texas History Center provided both an office and his constant support. His excellent staff found all the books I needed. Dr. Lewis L. Gould, chairman of the History Department, was at all times cooperative, as was Dr. L. Tuffley Ellis, director of the Texas State Historical Association, who put me in touch with many valuable contacts throughout the state. Jack McGuire of the Institute of Texan Cultures in San Antonio offered ethnic research material, and Dorman Winfrey, director of the Texas State Library, was continually helpful. John Wheat, an expert in Spanish studies, gave valuable help when requested. Since the university has 18 major libraries, with a total of more than 5 million volumes, it is a great place to work. Handbook of Texas. Any writer on Texas finds himself indebted to the Texas Handbook, a unique 3-volume encyclopedia. A treasure trove of historical research, it is now undergoing a monumental expansion to 6 large volumes that will require 10 years of work. It will then be indispensable to any serious student of Texas, and will have no equal in any other state. Assistance. John Kings, who had organized my office and helped on research for Centennial, proved once more that he is both an editor and an understanding colleague. Robert Worcester and Frank de la Teja, who are studying for their PhDs in Western History and Latin American History, respectively, were delightful to work with. Lisa Kaufman was most skillful in word processing and offered cogent comment. Her processor was a valued loan from Kenneth Olson, president of Digital Corporation. Debbie Brothers was most adept in coordinating the final revisions. Anders Sostrup, most knowledgeable in the minutiae of Texas history, carefully vetted the manuscript. In a most generous way, T.R. Fehrenbach, author of Lone Star, A History of Texas and the Texans, provided special help and original insights. Melissa Totten assisted with the sketches for the maps. I would also like to acknowledge those scores of loyal and enthusiastic Texans who sent me letters, diaries, manuscripts, books, and documents telling the stories of their ancestors, whose fortitude and resourcefulness contributed to the unique characteristics of this state. Their interest was remarkable, generous, unprecedented in my experience, and most encouraging to a northerner like me. Thank you all.
This concludes the reading of Texas by James A. Michener. This book was read by Larry McKeever. Copyright 1985 by James A. Michener. This recording of the full-length reading of Texas was published by arrangement with James A. Michener and was produced in 1992 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording, nor any part thereof, may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape, Incorporated.